Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at GayMormonStories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
This is Danny Parkinson. I'm ready for our next installment of Gay Mormon Stories. Today I'm going to be talking with Edward Jones. He is a lawyer in the D.C. area, but I just heard this rumor on his Facebook that he's moving back to Salt Lake. But anyway,
it's true.
We're not going to do our typical interview today, but we are going to talk about some elements that he's particularly interested in sharing about and that I'm particularly interested in hearing about his more recent journey that has kind of got him back into Mormonism in his own unique way after an absence from Mormonism, and also how Heavenly Mother has played a big role in that, and his ideas and theology in relation to Heavenly Mother that he's been developing and even writing about. And because of that, I think he is going to be able to carry on a very interesting dialogue about that. That's going to be really interesting to our audience. So, welcome, Edward.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and I'll just kind of let you, tell me what do you want to give us as far as introduction, and or do we just want to go in and let your story serve as an introduction?
Well, I'll just give a little background, first of all, about myself. As you and I have talked before, I was born into a Mormon family and grew up in Idaho and Utah. And I went on a mission to Paraguay and did a bunch of other Mormon-y kinds of things. I sang in the Mormon youth chorus, and I taught at the Missionary Training Center, and, you know, kind of thought of myself as a very, you know, good Mormon boy. But beneath all of that was, you know, a person who was gay. And so I would say about 13 years ago now, around 1999, 2000, I came out of the closet, and shortly thereafter, after some reparative therapy for a few months, realized that, you know, I was gay, and came out of the closet and left the church. And so that's just kind of the beginning of my spiritual journey. As you indicated, I've returned to church recently, and so I'm interested in talking about that and what I'm doing now.
Okay. So basically, after your mission, you were doing a pretty mainstream, faithful Mormon track. You were at BYU teaching in the MTC. But then basically the fact that you were gay kind of interrupted that.
That's right. And it was so shattering. I mean, I have friends who say, they never really believed, or, you know, different things like that. And for me, that's not true. Like, I was definitely a believer. And the whole Mormon worldview was my worldview. And so I really felt like the church was this, you know, immovable object, and my homosexuality was this irresistible force. And the two, you know, something had to kind of break there. And so I was reading in the Psalms one day, and I read the 139th Psalm, which basically says that God, you know, created us in our mother's womb, that he knows our thoughts before we think them and our words before we speak them. And also that he says, you know, the psalmist says, the light and the darkness are the same to you. Wherever I go, God is there. Like, if I go to the uttermost limits of the sea, if I make my bed in hell, God is there. And so at that moment, I realized it didn't matter to me so much what the church thought. It mattered to me what God thought. And I knew that God made me gay, and that was okay.
Okay, so this really was a soothing scripture that kind of helped ease the exit from Mormonism at that time in your life.
That's right.
Yeah.
So then I left the church. I transferred away from BYU to the University of Utah, and one of the first things that happened to me is that I went with a friend to the Mormon Women's Forum annual conference, and I heard there a woman named Margaret Toscano speak, who, as you know, is a Mormon feminist extraordinaire and
professor
of classics at the University of Utah. And I was utterly entranced by her and what she was saying, and became, I think, on the spot, a Mormon feminist.
Okay.
And I also started taking her courses at the University of Utah and would end up graduating in classics because of her.
Classics,
a Greek and Latin.
Okay.
And then this was also a part of my life where not having the restrictions of the church anymore, you know, I had a lot of sex, or I began taking drugs, which led to an addiction for me. And so in terms of my spiritual journey, there was kind of this vacuum. But people, there can be some judgment there about the sex. And I'm still thinking over that in my mind. I think a lot of it was beautiful. But in terms of the drugs in particular, it took me to a dark place. And that is where the issue of Heavenly Mother came in. I knew that Mormon feminists talked a lot about Heavenly Mother. And in fact, I should go back and say that although I had always known there was a Heavenly Mother, I didn't really think that much about her until I was a freshman at BYU and I was in the Honors General Education building. And they had Sunstone and Dialogue sitting around in there. I mean, this was, you know, in 1994. This was a while back.
Okay.
But still, one might be surprised to find those at BYU in the Carl G. Mazur building. But I was there and I read, you know, I just flipped open this book and I read Janice Allred's article, Toward a More Theology of God the Mother.
Uh-huh.
And as you already know, this is an article in which she lays forth her idea that God the Father gave up his body to come to the earth in the form of God the Son, Jesus Christ. And she finds support for that in the Book of Mormon, which identifies Jesus as the Eternal Father. And then she also believes that the Heavenly Mother set aside her body to become the Holy Spirit. So that's her theology.
Okay, so she's a Mormon scholar.
Oh, yes. I should point out, yes. So Janice Allred is a Mormon feminist as well. She happens to be a sister of Margaret Toscano.
Oh, okay.
But she... And if our listeners have not read Janice Allred's work, her articles, they really should. She has a very fine, very logical, philosophical mind, very rigorous.
Uh-huh.
In any case, so I read this article, and it, you know, I remember pointing a friend to it and saying, like, oh my gosh, you know, this is, you know, blasphemous and amazing.
Right.
So my little Mormon mind just kind of exploded. I put that in the back of my mind. This was, you know, before my mission. So that was kind of the first seed of an issue with a thought about Heavenly Mother.
Uh-huh.
And so fast forwarding back to this time, I had begun to experiment with drugs, and the drugs, it became more and more serious and started taking me to a more and more spiritually desolate place. And at a certain point in that, I realized...
Are you inclined to tell us what drugs you were using, or...
Yeah, no, it's totally fine. It was crystal meth, which, I mean, I think also, you know, people have some misconceptions about that, like, oh, like, was I living in, you know, a trailer in the middle of nowhere and my teeth were rotting out or something? It wasn't, you know, quite like that. It was more of a party drug, but the kind of party drug that sometimes lasts, you know, into Monday and Tuesday and so on. So this was taking me to a dark place, and at a certain point, I realized, like, I could not help myself. Like, I could not control this, despite my own greatest efforts.
Uh-huh.
And I also didn't, for some reason, I did not feel like I could call on Heavenly Father. I didn't feel like I had the right relationship with him. It perhaps something to do with the church. But I knew that in my kind of desperation that I could call on Heavenly Mother. And so that is what I did. And I remember just feeling, you know, this amazing sense of love. And the kind of thing, like, you know, when you're a child and you spill the milk or you do something and it seems so tragic, you know, and then somebody comes, you know, and says, you know, we'll fix this. And that was the kind of thing I felt, you know, like I had messed up my life, but here was this person who could help me fix it.
But this was more than just an intellectual realization. This was a profound spiritual sense is spent up. I mean, do you care to describe that more?
You're exactly right. I mean, the idea of Heavenly Mother does appeal to me intellectually, definitely. But this really was a felt kind of thing, almost like a kind of bodily sense of being enveloped. Certainly, you know, what Mormons would call, I mean, Mormons are, I think, very good at spiritual intuition, at, you know, sensing, you know, when the spirit is with them or that kind of thing. Yeah. I think this was a similar experience. Like, I knew that she was there for me and that she cared for me very much and was going to help me.
Yeah.
And that help for me came in the form of a 12-step group, which I have now been attending for a number of years. And that was the thing that I needed. And as you know, 12-step groups, you know, focus on a higher power. And
right.
So she became, you know, that higher power for me that helped get me away from drugs.
So Heavenly Mother fit the conceptualization of a higher power that really you need to work the 12-step program.
And so, as strange as it may seem, I feel like there are a lot of contradictory things that go on in me. And whenever these things surface, I think of a line from Walt Whitman where he says, "Do I contradict myself? Then I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes."
Okay.
So I left Salt Lake City in 2004. I should say that I graduated in classics in 2001.
Uh-huh.
I worked for the state government in Salt Lake City for a few years. And then, like all good humanities majors who aren't very good at math, we decided to go to law school instead.
Okay.
The business school. So I went to the University of Iowa Law School. And law school teaches you to kind of think rigorously in a particular way and to kind of demand evidence, you know, and weigh evidence for things. And so during that time, I became an atheist. I looked around me and despite my past experiences, many of them, I came to think, well, you know, there's no evidence to show that, you know, some metaphysical realm exists. And so, you know, why should I believe a thing for which there is no evidence?
Uh-huh.
And so I was happily atheist. And I remember a Mormon friend of mine saying to me, I went back home to Monroe, Utah to visit her, and I was kind of describing my belief system. And she said, well, you know, you're in a really unpleasant place right now. You know, why don't you come back in a few years when you're in a better place? and I thought that was, you know, just a bunch of bullshit. And I still think that that was an important kind of thing for me to go through mentally.
But were you sort of an agnostic atheist where you just didn't feel like you could know? Or were you an atheist where you were just sure there was no metaphysical explanation?
That's a good question. I did understand the distinction back then. I thought of myself as an atheist. You know, I certainly wasn't one of these Richard Dawkins types who was quite insistent that other people be atheists.
Uh-huh.
Or the thought of, you know, religion as being just completely insane. One thing that attracted me to atheism was the simplicity of it, that there's not this whole superstructure on top of life, that, you know, life is what we get. And the idea that life begins when we're born and it ends when we die, made life more precious to me, I think, because like this really, you know, was all I got. It made me responsible, you know, for this instead of thinking, well, you know, there's this power that's going to make everything better in the end or make everything right. Or, you know, I don't have to worry about the world's problems or, you know, whatever I thought. And there was some to this day, there is something beautiful about the idea of death being just the end.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that most religious people can't conceptualize that a person who's sort of atheist, or even myself, although I don't really claim to be atheist, I also can see how there is beauty in that, the idea that, you know, this is our time, but it has an ending.
Yeah.
And so I get it, but I think that, yeah, most people who haven't explored that idea don't find themselves easily there, right? Thinking that they think of atheism as a place of despair, whereas most atheists will clearly just say that, but no, that's not the case.
I think that's right. And I think a lot of atheists are actually, you know, quite compassionate people. I think the kind of people who Jesus, you know, might approve of.
But let me ask you a question about that period just the same. how did you frame those spiritual experiences? Because if that, you know, for example, that intense experience you had when you called upon Heavenly Mother that really, you know, gave you something that you really felt, did you have to reinterpret that or did you set it aside? I mean, where did you put those ideas?
I think part of it is has to do with just suggestibility. And so I think I should say that right now I'm agnostic. I really kind of lean either way, you know, depending on the day, but I'm agnostic. And so a lot of the things that I see that happen, for example, in Mormon church or other, you know, churches are very, there's a lot of suggestibility. Like people's, you know, like, oh, don't you feel this? Oh, don't you feel this? Oh, you know, until people say, well, like, yes, of course, you know, I feel this. You know, or we say, like, I know this, I know this, I know this, until everybody, you know, we say, I know this. And so I realized that a lot of that was, you know, had been going on, and that allowed me to discount some of those experiences. But I think the main thing, which is something that I come to now, people ask me, you're agnostic, Edward, how can you go back to Mormon church? And I say that for me, I distinguish between the internal and the external. Uh-huh. I think I have no idea in the external world, in the universe, if there is some higher power or not, if there's God or a metaphysical existence. But I do know that there is something inside me, some kind of interiority. And so, as I was saying to a friend recently, I don't know, and it doesn't matter to me whether the historical person Jesus resurrected or not. But what does matter to me is that the Jesus inside of me resurrects, you know, every day, that he brings life from death, you know, inside me. And so that is the kind of thing that I look for now that motivates me, the internal richness that I feel.
Uh-huh.
That is the direction. So to continue the story, I think I gradually, I think after law school, I think people often talk about deprogramming, but just kind of the stress waves, like leaving them after law school and things relaxing a bit.
Uh-huh.
And that happened to me. And so I think for several years now, I've been in this place of agnosticism, which is intellectually honest while it allows me to pursue this kind of inner richness.
And so I'm sure most our audience knows what agnostic is, but let me just redefine in case to me, agnostic means a recognition or a belief that we can't really know the whole story or the whole truth. And therefore, we sort of reject any sort of dogmatic, this X, Y, or Z is the full truth kind of thing. And so a lot of atheists call themselves agnostic too, but there's some atheists who are definitely not agnostic. They just think, no, there is no God. But an agnostic person would say, no, we don't know. But the same agnostic person would say, well, there might be some sort of metaphysical or deity or something that you might call a god. So that's the difference. Is that how you would say it? Okay.
I would say that's right. And I would also add that for me, there's a personal element. So it's not just, you know, we don't know. It's that I don't know. And I like how Terrell and Fiona Gibbons in their book, The God Who Weeps, talk about a certain Doctrine and Covenants verse that says, to some is given to know that Jesus is the Christ or something like that, but to others is given to believe on their words. This idea that not everybody needs to know that there are two different gifts and that they're both. And so I'm comfortable with the idea that there are people who know that the church is true and Jesus exists and all of that. You know, that is their gift. And I think that actually my not knowing is also a beautiful gift and has a place in the church.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me. It doesn't necessarily make sense based on what we hear, basically what we're sort of told all our lives.
Yeah.
But it doesn't resonate a lot with people who find themselves there and just realize that they have to accommodate that they shouldn't just hang there and just feel like, oh, no, I'm not doing this good enough because God hasn't given me the answer kind of thing. Therefore, you know what I'm trying to say, that we are taught to blame ourselves if we don't have a sureness. And at some point we have to come to at least some of us have to come to an acceptance that we're not going to get this exact firm answer, right?
Yes. Well, and who knows in the future? I mean, you know, something may happen tomorrow and I suddenly may, you know with perfect clarity.
Right. But today you're not sitting here going, well, it's because I'm sinning or because I'm not faithful enough or because I'm not trying
hard enough. No.
Yeah. So it's a different framework, at least from at least what we went through as part of our younger Mormon experience.
It is. And it allows me, the agnosticism allows me to approach the church in this very different way. I do want to talk in a moment about how kind of biographically I came toward the church, how I was working with a therapist and came to back to Mormonism that way. But I just wanted to say in terms of the agnosticism that if one literally believes that there is this guy, Jesus, who's in the sky, who's talking to, you know, the prophets and apostles, and that they, you know, say things for, you know, that the whole authority structure is valid, that, you know, you're kind of in the place where most Mormons are. And that is a great place for them. You know, I'm not really kind of judging that, but that's not my place. And so I come to the church as a person who, the thing that attracts me to it is that the symbols of Mormonism, scriptures of Mormonism they're inside me. I mean, I grew up with them, I read them, and they are this kind of richness inside me. And so for me, instead of asking the question, is the Book of Mormon historically true? I would say, I have no idea if it's historically true. I suspect it's not, just given the evidence that we have right now. But that doesn't matter to me, because the question is it spiritually true? Like, does it grow inside me?
Uh-huh.
And so as I read some of the beautiful parts in the Book of Mormon that resonate for me, I say, you know, I'm going to take those things. But it also means that if the leaders say to me, well, you know, you have to do this and you have to do that, my attitude is, well, you know, I will be the one. I am the highest authority for me, and so I will take what you say into consideration. And if it resonates, you know, with me, then I will do it. That's also, not an easy thing for a lot of Mormons and non-Mormons and former Mormons to understand. I was actually just recently talking, there are several different Facebook groups of, you know, gay Mormons or ex-Mormons having to do with the gay Mormon thing, as you know. And I was talking to one of them that tends to have people who are gay and who are formerly Mormon and who are quite unhappy with the church. And in talking with them, these are great guys, but mostly men. They're great, by the way. But a lot of them are still they rest on the same assumptions the church has given them. They're just kind of on the other side of the coin. So for example, the church says it's either all true or it's all false. Like if Joseph Smith really saw God, that's their argument, right?
Yeah.
And if you say, well, I learned that certain things about the church aren't true and therefore it's all false, you are still existing in the same paradigm that they have. You're just on the other side of that. And so for me, I'm a person, you know, I'm a proud cafeteria Mormon, and I say, you know, people should do what is truly right for them.
Right. But you're definitely approaching your Mormonism in a way that's not the most common way.
No.
But no one should be able to say it's not a valid way. In fact, it's a way that there's lots of people approaching lots of religions today, is that people are sort of saying, well, the mythology, the allegory, it's all super interesting. We don't think it's literal, but we find it very useful. Now, that's really common, especially, say, in Americans who are discovering Buddhism, for example, that the literal belief is less common than someone who would just use it as allegory, right? But that's very uncommon in Mormonism, but it's becoming more common, and it's certainly becoming more common among people who really want to hang on to their cultural Mormonism and also want to keep their spiritual home in Mormonism. And it sounds like that's kind of where you're at, that you are a person who falls, maybe if you fall in any group, that would be the group, the one that sees value in maintaining your spiritual home there.
That's right. And it's interesting that you mentioned Buddhism, because thrown into the whole mix of these things that were happening to me with Heavenly Mother and atheism and agnosticism was that as part of my 12-step experience, as you know, in the 12-step group, you have a sponsor, and this person is a kind of guide for you. And my sponsor is a guy named Luke, who is a Buddhist, and he started me into meditation and reading in Buddhist ideas, which is something that I still do. And as the listeners may also know, Buddhism is not necessarily a religion in the sense that it makes metaphysical claims. It's really just kind of a way of living in this world. And so even though there are gods and goddesses in Buddhism, they generally tend to see them as aspects of the human personality or these projections of the human mind. And so then the Dalai Lama says to people, you shouldn't convert to Buddhism. You should become a Buddhist Christian or a Buddhist, you know, Muslim or a Buddhist Mormon or whatever you already are.
Right. And that's how I see Buddhism too, because I've also, I mean, I haven't done so much that I'm that able to, you know, explain to people what Buddhism is. But and there are people who do see it as a religion, but I think most practitioners of Buddhism, at least in the United States, are people who don't see it as a religion at all, who really virtually don't. There's atheist Buddhist. I mean, you should totally be an atheist to be a Buddhist, because it's not a religion. That's, I think more and more people are discovering that Buddhism is in no way, in any way, shape, or form, contrary to Mormonism. A totally true believing Mormon could totally be a Buddhist too. For that same reason, but although it's that's probably less common, but it's certainly possible.
And even the label Buddhist is not important to, I think, many Buddhists. And so one could even say, you know, a Mormon with Buddhist practices. But you know, Mormons talk about prayer and meditation, but my experience is that they don't actually do a lot of meditation. And so later in this interview, I hope to talk about my work with primary children here in Washington, D.C. and helping them learn how to meditate.
Would you say that again? With what kind of children?
Primary children.
Primary children, okay.
Yes. So I want to take up one or two threads of what we were talking about.
Okay.
I feel like I have short-term memory problems sometimes, so I need to go, you know, pick these things up before I completely forget them.
Good idea.
One thing I wanted to say was about the literalism. You know, I talked to my parents. They're wonderful people. And, you know, they're people who believe that there was a garden and a snake and the snake talked to people. And, you know, I think like many Mormons, they are literalists.
Right.
And I think that seeing things allegorically or symbolically is how many rabbis have historically seen it. How many, like, of the church fathers, I think the literalism is not unique to America, but I think is particularly American. Like, we're kind of very hard-headed, fact-oriented people. So there's the literalism there. I would argue that seeing things symbolically or allegorically actually makes them more rich spiritually, because you're not worried about, well, you know, were there horses in, you know, blah, 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 or if the prophet made the sun stop, well, I mean, you get into all these, like, crazy questions about the historicity of things.
Right.
And proving the historicity of things. And that's, you know, well, if we prove the historicity of this, then that means that it's true. And for me, that's all it takes away from the larger allegorical reality of things, the symbols. And I guess that's a good segue into the other thing that I was going to remember to say, is that this is how I came back to Mormonism. I feel like I reached a place with 12-step kind of spirituality and Buddhism where I was feeling pretty good, and I started seeing a therapist related to kind of these drug issues that I had had. And this therapist was a Jungian therapist, taking on the ideals of Carl Jung. I only say that because people say, oh, what kind of union therapist? Like, he's part of a union, you know? Union. The union therapist. Jungian therapist. And he really helped me. We started talking about my dreams, which, you know, I had always, growing up in central Utah with, you know, I guess there was a certain attitude about therapy in general. But, you know, all the, like, dreams, you know, I mean, they're just, you know, random things. And so I came to see through this therapy that, you know, dreams do reflect a certain part of our unconscious, that we can learn things about our unconscious from dreams and from other things. And this all sounds like a big setup for me talking about a particular dream, which is, it is not. It's I. But through this therapy, the therapist helped me realize that there were unresolved issues around Mormonism in me. Uh-huh. And he said, Edward, you left the church so quickly that it seems like there's this Mormon trapped inside you, like, you know, rings inside of a tree. And we need to find some way to deal with those issues. And so I was thinking about that, and this is about a year ago. And I started reading about gay Mormons who were returning to activity in the church. And so I read about Mitch Main, who I think you and all of our listeners will know,
right,
is an active gay man in California who's part of his bishopric there. And so I sent him an email, and he pointed me to Randall Thacker, who is now president of Affirmation, Gay and Lesbian Mormons, and who's in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And it turns out that he and I live not too far from each other and are in the same ward boundaries.
Okay.
And so after some thought, I felt like it was the right thing for me to go back to Mormon church.
Okay.
And
that, because again, you acknowledged that it was, that you were unresolved there, or was it because you were embracing this idea that the Dalai Lama had, that you should really try to find your spirituality in your, you know, in the religion that you were born in or something, or that you grew into? Were those playing a role, that Buddhist concept?
Yeah. Yes. I'm a person, I've discovered that, much like George W. Bush, I do things from the gut a lot. Like, I'll make decisions, and then afterwards, I'll make up reasons for those decisions.
Uh-huh.
But really, the reason was that it felt like the right thing for me to do at the time, you know. But of course, there are more subliminal factors happening there. And so, I mean, definitely this, the psychologist bringing up the kind of Mormon issues and me realizing, I mean, I'd said for years that there were certain patterns within Mormonism that continued in my life, you know, even though I didn't believe the doctrines anymore. Yeah, it felt right, like the right thing to do. And there was also a sense of calling there, a sense of service. I felt somehow called by Heavenly Mother to go back to the church and to do several things, you know, one of which was to be a gay person in the church, to show people that, you know, to rub elbows with people and show, you know, them that I'm a human, that I'm doing the same things that they are, to make a place for gay people in the church. And also, but to tell people more about Heavenly Mother, about my experiences. And I've since discovered Mormon feminism as well.
Yeah.
And so those are kind of my big, the things that interest me most, yeah, church activity.
Okay. So how long, this was not that long ago, really, then. This was.
Yeah, so this past August, I started going back to church.
So it's been less than a year that you're really at it there. Okay.
And that, people might be curious, I don't know, but my experience in going back to church was not at all what I feared it might be. I perhaps have like the most liberal ward in the church. I don't know. I mean, there's probably some contest for that, but I mean, it's all Obama bumper stickers as far as the eye can see in the parking lot here in Washington, D.C.
And these are Mormons.
Wow. This is also, Mormons tend to live in the suburbs, at least in D.C., you know, so they're any number of stakes and wards, you know, out in Virginia or in Maryland, but inside the district itself, it's, I think we were a branch for a long time before there was even a ward here.
Oh, okay.
And so it's very, this ward is very diverse, I would say. The majority of people are either African refugees or African Americans. Then the rest of people are kind of hyper-educated white people who either live in the district or are transferring through with kind of government type positions.
Uh-huh. Is this Randall Thacker's ward then, or is he going to?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So Randall goes here. And in fact, I think the first Sunday that I came, first or second, you know, he had been going for about a year before I got there. So
does he actually attend services with his partner?
Yeah, they go sometimes. I think his partner's not Mormon.
Okay.
And so I think he shows up for special occasions.
Okay. But anyway, he's been a visible part of that ward for a year before you got there.
Yeah. And I learned, actually, that several months before I had gotten there, somebody from the stake PR, so it actually turned out it was the stake president's wife, but who was on a PR committee, came by and, this was during the election, the presidential election. And because reporters, especially around here, might be asking church members, you know, what Mormons think about a variety of things.
Right.
You know, they talked about various kind of PR, you know, possibly contentious issues. And the issue of homosexuality came up. And Randall, I think, very bravely stood up and, you know, said that he is a gay Mormon, and which was his first official acknowledgement in the church that was true. And he said that after that, he felt just enormous support and love in the ward. So
okay,
he's paving the way, a pioneer, really.
Well, that's nice that there can actually be a ward that does respond to that with enormous support. So.
And a lot of it has to do, yes, I agree. You know, and just as a tangent, the other day I mentioned one of these Facebook groups that I was talking about, and some of the individuals on the Facebook group were saying, you know, Edward, your experience is really extraordinary because you happen to be in this extremely liberal ward, and, you know, so good for you that this great stuff has happened, but that doesn't really help people who are, you know, living in Pace in Utah or wherever.
Yeah.
And there is a way in which I forget kind of how good I have things in general. Like, I live in, you know, Washington, D.C. I'm not, you know, I don't face a lot of the pressures that maybe a gay teenager in Omaha might face or something.
Right.
But at the same time, I mean, this is how change starts. I remember a former member of the bishopric of this ward was telling me that as recently as 10 or 12 years ago, they were getting lists of people from Salt Lake City who had somehow been identified as gay, you know, members of the church who had not been coming for a long time. And they were supposed to track these people down and excommunicate them.
Wow.
And, you know, they did some of that. And one of these people committed suicide. And so finally, he was just like, no, I'm just not going to do that anymore. You know? So I think, you know, even here in DC, I mean, there's, you know, one can see the change. I mean, this is how it starts.
Yeah. Well, there's undeniably a bigger group of people who are straight allies that just weren't there before. I mean, there was a few people before, but now there's a lot of Mormons who really are on the ally side of the aisle, who support marriage equality, who support gay rights, who support the church accepting lesbian gay people. So even if they're only a majority in a few places, they are in existence in a lot more places, and that is also a start of a big shift, a big seed that is planted in a lot of places, right?
Oh yeah, and I point this out to pretty much everybody. I mean, the demographic trends are so clearly in our favor. I mean, young people. I mean, not only, you know, are they not anti-gay, they just don't understand. Like, they don't understand why gay people can't get married or whatever. It's just not an issue at all to them.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, as a person who approaches the Mormon hierarchy, like, I like to say realistic, whatever, you know, I approach them not from a standpoint that they're, like, terrible people or that they're perfect. They're people who respond to institutional pressures. And one of those pressures is that on the one hand, they have a lot of conservative Mormons who would not be happy with change accommodating gay people. But on the other hand, they have a lot of people who are leaving the church, especially in North America, because of these issues.
Yeah. And a lot of people who aren't joining or aren't interested in joining because of these issues.
Yeah. And so when the bottom line, so that sounds very abstract, like, oh, a lot of people are leaving. But it's made clear to me, like, one of my mission companions was telling me that he and his wife and their two children are leaving the church because of the church's treatment of gay people. And so he couldn't understand why I was returning to the church at the same time. You know, or a family that I just met, you know, there he's the first counselor in the branch presidency, and, you know, she was the Relief Society president or something, and they are taking their children, you know, out of the church because they don't want them to, you know, learn the kinds of things that the church teaches about sexual orientation and gender and so on.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, the church is losing these people, and they will need to get themselves out of this corner that they painted themselves into somehow.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say. We don't know what they'll do. And there are plenty of churches out there who decide to just let the more liberal people go and they become even more conservative. But that doesn't seem to be the direction the Mormon church tends to move in a global way. We have tended to slowly, very slowly, snail pace, but move towards being more liberal, you know, more accommodating to mainstream sort of perceptions and theology, which, you know, because if you look at what the church used to be extremely marginal, and the direction we've come from there has become much more towards mainstream. So it's only logical that they would, that since the efforts have been made to go mainstream and theology has kind of been adapted and certainly practice has been adapted and certainly some doctrines and revelations have made that easier, it does kind of argue to have some optimism that it'll happen also with this issue.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that something people miss too is that even though the brethren respond to these kinds of institutional pressures or societal pressures that we're talking about, I think that then, you know, the bottom line, which is a big deal for them, they're also, I think, thoughtful, generally compassionate people who do want to, who do feel like they have a relationship with Jesus Christ and who do want to do the right thing. And so I think that it's unlikely for them to say, oh, we just need to cut these people off or we're going to, you know, first of all, they really like the idea of the church growing and, you know, all the time. And so for them to say, well, you know, we're going to accept being a smaller organization and within this population that's increasingly believing something different, that does seem unlikely that they will do that.
Yeah. I mean, but there are churches who are doing that, the Jehovah's Witnesses, and who are definitely doing that. I mean, Westboro is an extreme example, but there are plenty of churches who are just saying, okay, we'll separate ourselves from not just the mainstream, but we'll separate from our own believers who are migrating towards mainstream, and if they leave, they leave. So,
that's right.
You know, it is possible that they could change their mind and go that direction, I mean. But it just seems unlikely based on the trends so far.
Yeah.
And the Boy Scouts is an example. I mean, we're not seeing the Mormon Church as being all that progressive, but there are some major churches who left the Boy Scouts.
Yes.
As a result of that change, and we didn't. So, I mean, it's just one sort of small thing, but it is evidence that that they are able to at least take into account some assessment of reality, right?
Yeah, well, and the great thing about the Boy Scouts thing, too, was that they could make this concession, if we're going to call it a concession, they could agree to this change while also stating that they were not changing anything at all because they don't believe any youth should be having sex, which includes gay youth, and so, you know, the gay youth are free to join the Scouts. You know? So, I mean, they're putting their thinking caps on.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it is changing something. I suspect that if this had become an issue 15 years ago, the Mormon Church might have taken a different stance on that. But when it came out 6 months after they had this highly publicized website where they clearly said they wanted the gay people to feel welcome in their congregations, then to have them associate with something that's directly excluding them seems wildly hypocritical. And so it seems hard to me to believe they would have put out that website right before doing something that's so blatantly the opposite of what they're claiming on the website. So I guess I wasn't surprised. Yeah. In fact, I always suspected the church was sort of behind the scenes. I don't know if this is true or not at all, trying to get them to change. Like I say, I for better, for worse, or for whatever their intentions or motivations were for doing it, it does make sense. It was putting them in an awkward position, actually, to be associated with the old policy, because so that's what they were supposedly claiming they didn't have.
Well, and certainly BSA would not have done anything without, first checking with the church. I mean, if the church had been opposed to it, I mean, this never would have come to a public debate. But, yeah, so, well, and just kind of on a tangent there, I think people don't understand what the variety of views is within the leadership itself. Because the leadership tends to present itself only, to say what decisions they've made, and we don't get to know, what were the views or the viewpoints. We think of them as being monolithic. But it seems, from our information that people tend to think that the brethren act monolithically, that they all agree on everything all the time. But there's reason to believe that some of the apostles feel much more friendly or much more, willing to include gay people in the church than others.
Okay. And that might make sense, that what comes out of the church official, they obviously agree on showing a united front, whatever the decision is, and that's how Mormonism works. But what we don't know is really what discussions are happening behind the scenes. And we only assume that there is at least some diversity in opinions within the 12. I mean, it's obvious. If there's 12 people, there has to be diversity of opinions.
Yeah, and I think this past conference was perhaps the most public display of disagreement, Mormon style, between apostles that there's been since, the wars with James E. Talmadge regarding evolution. But when, you probably know what I'm talking about. Yeah. Elder Packer was talking about, the dangers of tolerance, the tolerance trap.
Right.
And at the very end of conference, President Monson gets up and encourages everybody to have more tolerance. So clearly, different views there.
But that was heartening, although some people are perfectly able to take that information and not see them as being contradictory. To me, they seem contradictory, but anyway.
So getting back to, I just wanted to say something about my returning to church, which is that the bishop of the ward that I'm in, I talked to him the first Sunday, introduced myself, and we sat down, and I kind of told him my situation, and he genuinely welcomed me into the ward and, talked about some close personal friends that he and his wife have who are gay, and some of whom are in the church and some of whom are not in the church. And I asked him, can I take the sacrament? Like, is there some kind of, process or whatever? And he said that that's a decision between me and God, that he is not my judge in that situation. To which I mentally thought, well, that's precisely what he is, judge in Israel, right? But I have come to see the wisdom of that. I do take the sacrament. And the sacrament is a very powerful symbol to me. And for me, it has nothing to do with, proclaiming my righteousness. If I don't meet certain, criteria, I can't, take the sacrament. I mean, it seems like it's actually the opposite, that, the people who Mormon leaders prevent from taking the sacrament are probably the people who need, that spiritual strength. And so for me, what it represents is, the broken bread is Christ's broken body, right? And so when I take that inside of me, I am kind of taking the brokenness of the world inside of me and saying, I'm going to do the work of God in the world, which is healing the brokenness. That's my view. Anyway, so...
But it's nice that this bishop is able to keep being a bishop and have those kind of attitudes. And I hope it's just not because it's an oversight on the part of the church that they have a bishop that liberal, but that it's really that he has room to be that way. And hopefully that's another kind of attitude we hope will spread.
Yeah. And from what I've heard, our stake president, who is, I think, the son-in-law of Marriott or something like that, that he has more kind of conservative views about homosexuality. But again, in the singles ward here in the DC second ward, I mean, there are gay guys galore, and I think people look the other way at that. Anyway, so in this ward, I mean, this is also a ward that needs people to fill callings, and they quickly
Are you in a singles ward then?
No, I should clarify. I'm not in the singles ward.
You're in the family ward. Okay.
I'm in the family ward. Okay. I did go to the singles ward one Sunday, first of all, I'm 37 years old, so I don't meet the age criteria for the
single. You would have been kicked right out.
Yes. Too yes. Old. Not, okay. I would not have been a threat to any of the young ladies there, however. The family ward where I am now is great, and they lost no. I mean, they really do look for people to fill callings, and when they identify people's talents, you know, they use them right away.
Yeah.
And so I'm a musician, and so they first called me to be an elders quorum pianist, and then they have a ward organ rotation. Different people play the organ each Sunday, and I'm on that rotation. And then this past January, they called me to be the primary chorister, or the primary music leader. And so that's what I've been doing since then.
Nice.
So one thing that I want to mention is that the diversity, even within our ward of gay people, there are people like Randall and myself who are, you know, affirmation, gung-ho, you know, it's okay that we're gay. You know, and in Randall's case, it's okay that I'm in a relationship with another man. You know, I'm here.
Yeah.
As people may know, Randall runs our Thursday tutoring program in which kids and adults from the ward can get tutoring in any subject that they need, and they really help a lot of people there. So there are those people in the ward, but there are also, there is a guy who, you know, deals with same-sex attraction and who is celibate and, you know, who comes to church, and, you know, he's never actually acknowledged that to me, you know, but it's kind of known. So, I mean, that's the kind of vibe there. There is a guy who is in an opposite orientation marriage?
Yeah, mixed orientation marriage.
Mixed orientation marriage, which is always confusing to me because, you know, if you both like dick, then is it, you know, mixed orientation? It seems like it's the same orientation, but anyway.
Anyway, they're both not heterosexual. I guess that's...
Yeah, yeah. One is, yeah.
That's
but as my mother sometimes says, you know, there's already gay marriage. My sister married a gay guy.
Really?
No, that was a joke. But,
okay.
I attribute sayings to my mother sometimes.
Okay.
Get back to her. So there is a diversity. And I would say on any given Sunday, there are between 5 and 10 gay people, you know, in the ward, kind of doing things. So I was called to be the primary music leader, which was good. And then one Sunday in January, the bishopric asked me to talk about how the gospel has changed my life. And there were maybe 3 people talking in sacrament meeting about that. And they said, be as honest as you want. And so I said, well, and, I gave a talk that people can find on my my blog at www.gaylymormon.com. And that was a bit controversial. One thing I did not know was that Mike Otterson, who is the head of PR for the church, I think, was there, as was the state president and a senator and some other people. So it was actually, in retrospect, nice to have this distinguished audience to say what I was going to say. But I told my whole story, you know, about being Mormon and then about my drug experience and about Heavenly Mother and about coming back to church. And at the end of it, I said, you know, now that in coming back to church, there are a few things that I realized for myself. And one of those things is that, you know, God has made me gay, and that's okay. You know, I'm fine as a gay man. And the other was that coming back to church, I realized there are no women sitting on the stand. I think the day may come, you know, when we have female priesthood holders. uh-huh. And so Anyway, I got, you know, a bunch of like thumbs up and hugs, you know, all that kind of thing. Like my ward is very, as I said, liberal and supportive that way. But at the end, the bishop, who he is a very, you know, kind man and in certain ways a very liberal man, but he's also an organization man. I mean, he's a business. He's a bishop, right? Yeah. And the state president was sitting right there. And so, you know, he gets up at the end and he says, you know, Robert is a member of the board and we're so excited that he talked to us today. You know, there are a few kind of doctrinal clarifications that I need to make. But interestingly, I mean, he talked about, and he said, you know, we do believe in Heavenly Mother, or we don't believe that we should pray to her. You know, we believe that men and women have equal roles, but men have the priesthood. And women don't. But he did not say anything about the gay thing.
Okay.
Which I didn't know if there were just so many things that I had said that were inappropriate. He couldn't catch them all.
He couldn't possibly address all of them. Well.
Anyway, that talk was a big deal for me. And I think significantly, I mean, and maybe Mormons are passive aggressive. Like they wouldn't, you know, have said anything anyway. It's run me off of the pitchfork. But I did, you know, and a number of people came up to me afterwards and said things like, you know, I pray to Heavenly Mother too, and I've just never said that out loud to anybody, or I'm also in a 12-step program.
Okay. You know,
or one kind of young, straight, married couple who had talked, I think they were talking right after me. They, as I sat, gave me big hugs, you know, and later told me that they left the church for a few years because of how the church treats gay people. And they were only recently coming back. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's really positive. And I guess it gave you a way to kind of identify who some of these people were, who you might have more in common with in your ward, but also give them a feeling of being less isolated. Because sometimes people who are a little bit non-traditional about their beliefs feel very isolated in these wards. And where they just really feel like they can't say these things. So I suspect it was really, in a way, inspiring for those people to hear that. So I'm not surprised they gave you the thumbs up.
And interestingly, I talked with the bishop afterwards about it. And he said that there were some people who came to him and had this concern, you know, should Edward be working in the primary? Since he's a gay guy, the fear apparently being that, you know, gay people are pedophiles or whatever. And to which he responded, you know, Edward is absolutely the right person, you know, for this job. Yeah. And which it turns out is true. So I wanted to mention a little bit about my work in the primary. When the bishop first called me in and said, I'd like you to be the primary music leader, I thought, well, this is a terrible idea. You know, other than having nieces and nephews who I do love, I've never really, I don't interact with children. I feared that there would be some kind of mutiny and they would end up tying me up and roasting me on a spit or something, like, you know, Lord of the Flies.
Yeah.
So I was like, this is not a good, I had pictured something more, you know, along the lines of gospel doctrine teacher, or which would probably never happen in a million years.
You never know.
And in fact, our gospel doctrine teacher marched in the Pride Parade.
Oh, good.
With us as our first counselor. But anyway, so I accepted the calling, and it turns out that the bishop's wife is the primary president, and she loves me. She loves Randall, who is the primary pianist. Okay. So I started this calling, and what I soon realized is that, A, the primary is a great place to start reforming the Mormon church, because people don't pay close attention to what you say to children. That's a terrible to put it. But you can, I mean, there are things that if you said them in gospel doctrine class, people would be like, but, right. You know, you say them in the correct way to children, and, you know, everybody just kind of, you know, smiles and nods. But the other thing is that I felt like I was giving a real service, that I am giving a real service to these children, because the church, my theory is this, the church is good at teaching the basic doctrinal structure of the church to children and to inculcating in them the behavioral expectations.
Yeah.
But what the church is not good at doing is teaching children the spiritual habits that lead to inner richness. Like, we assume if you teach a person the correct doctrine, that spiritual growth will just happen. And my experience, at least, is that that's not necessarily true, that there are things that we need to learn how to do.
Yeah.
And so I set about teaching these children how to do them. And one thing for me is aesthetic appreciation. Like, the world is a very beautiful place. And learning to appreciate that beauty and to know that that beauty comes from God and to thank God for that beauty is at least a big part of my spirituality.
Right.
And so to implement this specifically, we started listening to classical music. And so each Sunday, we have, it's just like a 2 or 3 minute clip from something. We've had a month of Mozart. We started out with Bach, a month of Bach, a month of Mozart, a month of Beethoven. And, talking about, some of these are from religious works. And so we talk about the context, of the work or whatever. Or sometimes I just have to have them identify, where the clarinet comes in this clarinet quartet or something. So we're working on aesthetic appreciation. But another thing is with meditation. I feel like we teach children to pray, at least in this very, very basic way, which I think some...
In a checklist way.
And I think like a lot of Mormon adults continue to pray in that way, which I think one can grow out of to something greater. But anyway, so there's the prayer, but we're not really taught to listen very much to God. And so I teach the children that prayer is when we speak to God and meditation is when we listen to God. And we, each week, we have a meditation object that we look at, whether it's a picture of the Savior or a flower or something.
Yeah.
And we spend a certain amount of time just looking at that and kind of freeing our minds. And we've built up to 70 seconds, which for children is an eternity.
Right.
And one of the mothers came to me last week, and she said that it occurred to her during the sacrament that her daughter was able to more fully, her young daughter was able to more fully focus on the sacrament because she had this training in meditation. I think it's important to teach children spiritual skills that will be valuable whether or not they're members of the church. I mean, a lot of these kids in particular in this transitory ward will not be members of the church their whole lives.
Yeah.
They'll come and go. So I have other theories around primary. I will spare your poor listeners.
Well, Edward, you're being pretty radical there. Classical music and meditation in primary is pretty heretical, I would say. But
Yes. Well,
I'm glad you're doing it. That is also something that we could use throughout the church.
I'm all about motion, too. So we do a lot of, I'm about motion. So we do a lot of getting up, making, dancing, that kind of thing. I introduced the idea of having perhaps some kind of liturgical dance as part of the primary program, but that did get shot down.
No shakers there. No.
But they said we could do clapping. And I also brought in non-church music. Like, I have a sister who I love dearly who lives in Idaho, who's very kind of conservative Mormon. And for her, the idea of bringing in music that was not, in an official church publication, she just nearly fainted when I mentioned it. But I got this African-American hymnal that's full of all kinds of great music. And we learned some of that in primary. And
some of the kids are African American.
Yes.
So this is some exposure even to their heritage in a way.
Yeah. And in fact, when the bishopric has focus, I mean, they really try to include everybody in this ward. And so a lot, sometimes we'll have solos in church or musical numbers that are traditional African American spirituals, and people really get into them. I mean, they identify with that as part of their spiritual heritage.
Yeah.
So let me think if there was one more thing that I wanted to say about helping the children out. I think that's pretty much it.
I mean, it sounds like you're magnifying your calling, and that's what we're taught to do, magnify it, make it the best possible be the best possible primary chorister you could be. And so that is taking on more than what most of them do. I don't think most chorators spend much time outside of their thinking about how to be a better chorister, you know?
Well, and in a way, I actually disagree a little bit, only in that a lot of primary choristers I know or talk to, they really try to do kind of what I will dismissively call cutesy things to engage the children. But they do crafty things. There's always something, you know, the children can like pick this flower out of the thing and put it over here. And the primary president did suggest that I might do some more of that stuff, but that's just not me, you know? I felt like, you know, we have some work to do. We're going to do this work. I think the children enjoyed it, but that was, I find that to be a little bit of talking down to children. And when I was in primary, I remember thinking, you know, a lot of this was insulting to my intelligence.
Yeah.
I think we have some really beautiful primary music, but a lot of the music in the children's hymn book is just dreck and needs to be burned. So. Well, I remember what I wanted to say, though, which is a larger observation. I think I remember Paul Toscano saying this in an interview one time. He said, the gospel is the most amazing thing ever. I mean, it's, you know, wide beyond comprehension and, you know, the most powerful, beautiful thing that there is. And yet, taking this thing that is so amazing, the general authorities are boring everybody to death. Like, you go to Sunday school and people are just dying of boredom. Yeah. You know, why is there this disconnect between the amazingness of the gospel and our presentation of it, which is so abysmal? Yeah. And I think that's exactly right. I think our medium does not match our message. And particularly in the area of music, when I have played the organ or conducted in sacrament meeting here, the first thing I do is I, you know, speed up the tempo by, you know, a good 4 or 5 clicks. And I cannot tell you how many people have come up to me after sacrament meeting and said, thank you so much for doing that. Like, I was able, you know, I mean, you can, if you sing There Is a Green Hill Far Away, like really slowly, I mean, the hill keeps getting farther away every time. You know, like, there is a green, I mean, it's just like funereal. Somebody on by Common Consent, which is, I'm sure people know what that blog is. If you haven't gone to it, go to it. A lot of the people there have some pretty serious experience with music inside and outside of the church. In one of their posts about church music, one of them compared some of the slower songs to listening to a whale sonogram, which is true. Yeah. So anyway, we could do some serious work in making our medium match our message.
Yeah, and I think Mormons are frightened of having enthusiasm happen inside the church. I mean, they don't associate reverence with enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And there certainly are some churches where there's huge displays of enthusiasm that's incorporated in their worship. And so I just wonder what would be so terrible about that if we did have more enthusiasm in our singing, at least.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
So there's that issue. You know, and I have to say, too, that for the listeners who, if there are any listeners who are gay, you know, or gay allies who have thought about going back to church, so I am glad that I did it. You know, obviously I'm having a good run of it, you know, right now. But I want to talk a little bit about just the sense of existential wrongness when I went back to church. I mean, I would, you know, even every once in a while now, but certainly for the first few Sundays, I went there and I felt like, you know, I'm in the fundamentally wrong place. Like, I'm a gay person, you know, in this church, and this is, you know, I mean, it's hard to describe my sense of just like being absolutely in the wrong or inappropriate place. But also recognizing that discomfort was part of the pioneering experience. Like I knew that I was doing the right thing, and that all pioneers feel uncomfortable, or else it wouldn't be pioneering.
Okay. So, I mean, I can see that I would probably feel really like I was in the wrong place if I was at church. I mean, I haven't been for some time, but I can certainly understand how that would come, but you're framing it in your case as just part of what you need to get beyond to really benefit maximally from the experience.
Yeah.
Or to frame it in a way that's positive for yourself.
Yeah, I think that's right. And this is reminding me of Carolyn Pearson's recent book, The Hero's Journey of the Gay and Lesbian Mormon.
Right.
A somewhat infelicitous title, as Mormons are usually either gay or lesbian, rather than gay and lesbian. But anyway, my quibbles with the title aside, I hope Carolyn is not listening to this. I love you, Carolyn, and I really do love your book. As you already know, but I'll point out to the readers, this book tracks Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, specifically in the context of a gay or lesbian Mormon. The idea being that there's this person who's called to do something outside their tribe, and they at first resist the calling, and then they end up leaving their tribe, and they kind of go through some trials and discover things about themselves. But there comes a point, at least for some of these heroes, where they need to go back to the tribe, and there's a level of discomfort. The tribe is distrustful because the hero has left them, and the hero is distrustful because they were hurt by the tribe. But the tribe is dying. The tribe needs the kind of knowledge and insight that the hero has. And so when the hero is able to come back and, you know, integrate back into the tribe is healthier. And that is exactly what I think. I was at this Affirmation leadership meeting a while back, they kind of got everybody internationally, all the leaders, together here in the D.C. area, and, you know, talking about strategy and different things. And they, a number of these leaders, I mean, they're clearly interested. I mean, they're meeting with, you know, church leaders. They're coming kind of hat in hand to them. You know, we really want to be part of this and stuff. And I think that that is a necessary thing. But I also reminded them that the church needs us. The church will clearly need us in a PR sense as society becomes more and more gay-friendly and the church's position becomes more and more anachronistic. Yeah. They'll need an organization like Affirmation to point to say, really, we're not, you know, terrible. But beyond that, I think a lot of gay people have a spiritual richness and vitality that the church is lacking. I humbly submit that I myself have a lot of vitality that the church is lacking, and I'm very happy to provide it to them. And so I think, you know, I think that part of the many exciting things we're seeing go on in Mormonism right now is this return of some gay people to the church.
Yeah, but not only that, not only what the gay people are providing, but the opportunity it's giving to straight people to reassess what the message of the gospel really is and what Christ-like love really is. And so in a way, it's just being there, even if you had no talents, also brings something to the church because of the allies I see also doing a huge job of revitalizing the church and making it, you know, making it into something that can last, that can be positive for people. So,
absolutely.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at GayMormonStories.org. If you want to see this podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation, again at GayMormonStories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. Music for this podcast was graciously donated by Clayton Pixton. Check him out at claytonpixton.com.
how kind his precepts are. Come cast your burdens on the Lord and trust his constant I'll drop my burden.